still struggling to nail down the benefits of mammography.
Is using a drug to dissolve the clot helpful in people that have blood clots to the lung?
Does exercise help depression?
And what's all this hype about the bionic pancreas?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on June 20th, 2014. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and vice chairman of medicine at the University of Texas, San Antonio.
Rick, I think we should start with the bionic pancreas. I really love this story. This is being presented or was presented at the American Diabetes Association meeting, also published in the New England Journal of Medicine.
And what was it that caught your fancy?
I just find it really fascinating, this idea that somehow we can construct things that work pretty well. They will never be a replacement for our God-given organs, of course. What else I found interesting about this story was the inclusion of glucagon in this device.
All right, so let's start from the beginning and describe what this bionic pancreas is and how it originated. It's interesting because the senior author is actually an engineer whose son developed type 1 diabetes before the age of 1 year. So he devised actually not one pump, but two pumps, one that secretes insulin that lowers glucose levels. The other secretes glucagon that raises glucose levels. And these two hormones work together to maintain the level of glucose in a normal situation where it's neither too high nor too low. There was continuous glucose monitoring. There were two pumps, one of which infused glucagon, the other infused insulin, and they were attached by an iPhone app. And they tested this in two populations. One is in adults that were within 3 square miles of the hospital, but they did their routine activity. They could eat whatever they wanted to eat. And the other was in an adolescent population, kids in a camp, where they were taught to treat their diabetes. In these two populations, they were already using an insulin pump. When they were transferred over to use the bionic pump, they had improved glucose levels and they had less frequent hypoglycemic episodes, both in adults and in kids.
And this, of course, is marvelous news. Now address this issue of glucagon also being administered, which we have not seen previously.
One of the problems with insulin is it can drop the glucose levels. This is particularly problematic at night when people may not manifest the usual symptoms. So by using glucagon, if the level gets a little too low, it can actually raise it up. And in this way, they were able to demonstrate they could actually reduce the number of hypoglycemic episodes in both adults and in kids. In adults, they reduced it by about 67%. In kids, it was less significant, but the kids needed to have less interventions to treat it.
Outstanding news, of course. Let's talk about ramping this up.
All right. This was a study only done for 5 days. There were occasional times where the glucose monitoring didn't work. And then there were several episodes where the wireless connectivity didn't act appropriately. It's sexy because it's called bionic, but is it ready for real world? Not yet.
And maybe the addition of glucagon to this and something that resembles something more physiologic will actually achieve that goal.
And ultimately, it's needed to be put in one pump instead of two, because this is right now cumbersome. Great proof of concept, but still a lot of work to be done.
Okay, well, let's turn to the other end of the spectrum. Something that's been out there for ages, that's breast cancer screening and the scrutiny it's coming under. Does it really have an impact on that hard endpoint, death? That's in the British Medical Journal.
If we were to say women shouldn't have mammography, we'd hear a huge outcry among our listeners. But essentially, that's exactly what the Swiss Medical Board recommended. And what this study did was it looked at the Norwegian database, it looked at women aged 50 to 79 between 1986 and 2009 when they began to institute mammography. They looked at over 15 million person years of observation. And here's what they discovered. It's just a very modest benefit of mammography in preventing death due to breast cancers. You need to screen about 368 women to prevent one breast cancer-related death. You say, well, that's worth it. Well, the flip side is, and this paper didn't address it, but previous ones did, is you have 3 times as many false positive results. What the editorialist mentions is that it's important for women to know what the benefits and the harms are for mammography. And as physicians, we tend to overestimate the benefits and underestimate the risk.
As you know, I decided a few years ago that I wasn't going to, just like you did with prostate cancer screening, forget about it. I'm only going to do it at an interval that I feel is going to result in the maximum potential benefit with the least pain in the neck and potential for harm. That's over-treatment, right? So I have to say that I agree with these conclusions of this study and really think that the American Cancer Society needs to revisit this because the public message that's out there right now is still annual.
So a couple things. One is the fact that you've chosen not to undergo mammography is not because you've buried your head in the sand. It's because you've looked at the data in toto, and you've weighed the benefits and the harms. And again, I think that's what we need to do, is to present to women in a very measured way. These are the benefits. These are the harms. And let the woman be involved in that decision-making process.
Okay. Let's turn from there then to something I like a lot, an intervention potentially for depression. That's exercise. And that's in JAMA Internal Medicine.
Now, Elizabeth, if there's an exercise-related study in the week, I can almost guarantee you're going to pick it. And I know that's both for your proclivity, that you enjoy doing exercise and you know of the health benefits, but also because you know they can treat many diseases or many conditions. Well, the real question is, how good are the data that exercise can actually help depression? So this was a meta-analysis of 39 different trials that evaluated whether exercise improved depressive symptoms, sometimes compared to no treatment, psychologic treatment, sometimes compared to drug treatment. The total number of participants is fairly small. Among those 39 trials, only 2,300 participants. And when they compared exercise versus no treatment or a control intervention, medication or relaxation or antidepressants, the benefits of exercise were really very modest, if present at all. So although we would like to recommend it, what we have to say is if we look at the data critically, the benefit is actually quite modest.
But exists. And of course, being a proponent of exercise for all the reasons you've already identified, I would say it's still a strategy that's worth thinking about in addition to the other things we know do help. And those might include antidepressants, cognitive behavioral therapy.
All right, so here's where the rubber meets the road. So you're going to recommend exercise. The next question is, well, what kind of exercise? Cardiovascular exercise? You're going to recommend resistance exercise.
Well, I'm going to devolve that right back to you and also to our favorite kind of trial, the huge prospective trial that randomizes people into those groups and looks at that specific outcome, which we don't have.
We don't have. And in fact, the association is better for resistance exercise than it is for aerobic exercise. But you're right, there's no head-to-head trials. Furthermore, we don't have any guidance about how often exercise should be done, or what the intensity should be, or what the durations should be. So although we say, well, if you have depression, let's exercise, we'll make things better, I have to say that we're not on firm footing for making precise recommendations in that regard.
All right. How about if we leave that one with our chicken soup hypothesis? It can't hurt, so why not try it anyway?
Go for it.
Okay. Finally, then, let's do our last one. And that's an issue we've been looking at a little bit for pulmonary embolism, the formation of clots that end up in the lungs. What about this strategy, thrombolysis? That's in the Journal of the American Medical Association.
And we're talking about this because it accounts for nearly 200,000 people discharged from the hospital each year with this diagnosis and about 30,000 deaths annually in the United States. 25 to 50% of the times the patient dies from it, it's not even clinically recognized. I don't want to give the impression that every blood clot to the lung results in death. There are people that have mild manifestations, some that have very severe manifestations, and then there are people in between, intermediate. The real question is what to do with those people with intermediate manifestations. And that was the question that this study attempted to address by looking at all the published data in which people with PEs and intermediate manifestations were treated with either thrombolytic therapy, clot-busting medication, or a typical anticoagulant. There were 16 trials of about 2,115 patients. And what they discovered is the patients who received thrombolytic therapy had a decrease in their mortality from about 3.9% to 2.2%. So the number needed to treat to prevent one mortal event was 59 patients. Unfortunately, there was a significantly increased risk of major bleeding, almost a threefold risk of major bleeding, and almost a fivefold risk of having intracranial hemorrhage. And in the end, what they decided was patients with intermediate risk should be treated on an individual basis. They're recommending that those over the age of 65 probably shouldn't receive thrombolytic therapy if they're at intermediate risk. People under the age of 65, it should be considered on a case-by-case basis.
Clearly, the definition of risk and benefit in folks who are in these intermediate categories is an ongoing clinical issue and comprises probably the majority of patients. So what are the individual strategies that you would use to manage a patient who presents with a pulmonary embolism but this intermediate range? What would you do right now?
Well, good question. First of all, I'd put them on an anticoagulant. And then what I'd say is that if they don't respond to typical therapy, then I would switch them over to thrombolytic therapy. And you say, how often does that occur? Fortunately, it only occurs in about 3 to 4% of people with an intermediate risk PE. But when it does, I think you got to be prepared to switch therapies.
So this is good information and hopefully will be used in this clinical judgment. For this week then, I'll reveal that, of course, I'm going to do the bionic pancreas in the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.